Global Scientist is here. Way, good to see him, Sean Duke. Good morning, Sean.
It's good to feel wanted.
Yeah, well, you are, right, by him. But he didn't recognise you. You're happy. Right, just to say, a hot as June. I mean, it's hot today, but I believe June was exceptional.
Yeah, it's a bit worrying when you look at it. NASA has been watching this, of course, and the American NOAA, which watches these things as well. And they see that June is 0.9 Celsius hotter. That's almost 1 degree hotter than the 20th century average. And it's the hottest June since records began in 1880, which is a long time ago. Now, the worrying part of this is that this is ongoing. And we all know about global warming. But this is the 14th consecutive month of record-breaking heat. So we seem to be into a cycle now of ever increasing hotter months. Now we could blame it a little bit on this El Nino, which people might have heard, which is this cyclical thing which happens in the oceans, and the oceans off the Pacific coast of America, they heat up and this causes effects which lead to warming. And that started, that kicked this off in April of 2015. But I mean, you know, that effect of El Nino should have waned by now because it's a cyclical effect. But here we are continuing to get hotter. And the interesting thing, another interesting thing, is that the previous hottest June going back to 1880 before this year, 2016, was 2015. So, you know, this is really now starting to be overwhelming evidence that we're going into a period of sustained heating. The question is where is all this going? And we know it's happening, but we don't know precisely what's going to happen. There's an assumption that we're just going to get a little bit hotter and we'll be able to adjust as we go forward. But there is a more disturbing scenario where we would reach a point where something changes in our climate, and something could change very quickly. Now, what they've also been reporting with this is that there's less ice up in the Arctic than we've ever had before. So, you know, if we've got less ice, then we've got more water. And if you've got more water coming into the oceans, this could lead to a number of effects. For example, one thing that they're worried about is we all know we have the Gulf Stream here in Ireland. So you could have the contradiction of global warming actually causing a major cooling in Ireland, because if you have all this Arctic Arctic cold water, cold ice if you like, and it melts, that's cold water then. It flows into the Atlantic and it could cut off the Gulf Stream, which is this warm water that comes across the Atlantic and keeps us all nice and cozy here and prevents us having frozen ports, which we otherwise would have. We're so far north. If the Gulf Stream was cut off, and I mean, it's a worry now with all this ice starting to melt, we're into unexpected territory, you know, and people would have seen The Day After Tomorrow, perhaps in 2004 with Dennis Quaid, which is a great film. It was put down as science fiction when exactly that scenario happened, when you had this big flow of water coming in from the Arctic, which went into the Atlantic, stopped the Gulf Stream, set off all these unexpected effects. We're into a new scenario where we really have no clue what's going to happen.
I heard recently that the ozone layer had repaired itself somewhere.
The ozone layer is repairing itself, yeah. Now, that's a separate thing, because that's to do with these deodorants and things that we used to use, chlorofluorocarbons, that we've got our act together on that and we've stopped using those. So that's a good thing, yes. So we're protected from the UV radiation from the sun to a larger degree. But this is separate. That's separate from the global warming issue that we're facing here. So really, what we need to do is we need to get into another energy that's not going to use so much carbon, because carbon is the enemy in all of this. Carbon in our fuels and heating our homes. We just need to speed up our move away from carbon, or else we're risking, you know, the climate. And these effects, they've seen these effects in the past actually happen quite quickly. This is the, because I've looked into it, it's called abrupt climate change. So you could have a period of very warm weather. You know, we've had a very warm Earth in the past where you had almost no ice on the poles, and that around the dinosaurs when they were around is a much warmer time, for example.
There's no carbon around then, though, was there?
No, but that's part of a bigger cycle. You see, the carbon thing is a mini thing happening inside a bigger natural cycle. So, of course, some people say it's all part of a cycle, but actually, no, there's an effect now from humans as well, which was never there before. But in any case, we could trigger a change that could move us very quickly from one to the other, which could happen inside decades rather than hundreds of years. Because one of the problems with all this is everybody thinks, all right, look, this is a problem for my grandkids, or I don't have to worry about it. It's not going to bother me next week. You know, I'll just get on with my life. But actually, things have changed fast in the past. Inside a decade, we've moved from a warm Earth to a cold ice age Earth very quickly. And that's what we have to watch out for.
All right. Sean Duke is the cool scientist. There'll be more from Sean after the news. We're going to talk about a breakthrough, perhaps in gene therapy when it comes to diseases and things. And then we're going to talk about life on Mars or whatever, if there is, with Sean in just a second on the morning. Sean Duke, the cool scientist, is back with us. We spoke about various aspects of the hot weather, but now we're going to turn to something else. And this perhaps is a breakthrough in the treatment of cancer and heart disease, which are not generally linked together, but they seem to be on this. Something to do, Sean, with gene therapy.
Gene therapy, yeah, they are linked because there's a gene that they found that actually is involved with the creation of blood vessels, angiogenesis, they call it. So when a cancer, we'd start with the cancer anyway aspect to this, when a cancer starts to grow, it needs blood, it needs a blood supply, and it actually has the ability to attract blood vessels over to whatever part of the body it's growing. And that blood is like oxygen that's going to feed that cancer tumour. So the thinking is, or one of the strategies to deal with a cancer would be, can we cut off its supply? Can we starve it of blood, starve it of oxygen? So that's one thing. Now, they found a gene that actually may be able to do that, may be able to starve the tumour of its oxygen, because this gene affects the growth of blood vessels, okay? So basically, if you have this gene, and you can turn a gene on or you can turn a gene off, you can modulate how it works. So if you turn it off, scientists have the ability to turn a gene off, that can reduce the growth of blood vessels. So if there is a cancer there in a particular area, if you introduce this gene therapy around to actually switch off its ability to attract blood to itself, turn off the ability to do that, then you could starve the tumour. So that's one thing that's very positive from this particular gene. Now, the other thing, the other aspect to it is, can we turn it on, the opposite? So can we actually get it to be more powerful in its production of blood vessels? And what use can we put that to? Well, if you turn on the gene, then it's going to make more, it's going to grow more blood vessels. Now, this is where the heart disease comes in, because in a lot of cases with a failing heart, there's a lack of oxygen, there's a lack of blood going through that, and there's not enough blood vessels being created. So if we turn on a gene that will allow that heart to develop new blood vessels, that should increase the supply of blood and the supply of oxygen going through that heart. So on and off can both be used differently for this one particular gene. And this is work that's been done in the UK by a reputable group, the National Heart and Lung Institute in the UK, which is a government-supported group. And it could be used for lots of other things, because blood vessels in different parts of the body, they sometimes go awry, if you like. You know, the people have circulation problems with the bottom of their legs or their ankles or something like that. Maybe we could use the gene therapy to actually grow new vessels in those body extremes, where as you get older in particular, you may have problems getting the blood supply around to bring all the nutrients, the things that all our cells need around the body. So it looks pretty promising. Early stages, but promising.
Yeah, good. All the breakthroughs. You have some hope, people, but as you say, further down the road. One more story that's in the science news this week. It's Sean Duke, the cool scientist, and that is Mars. Yeah. You love talking about Mars.
I love talking about Mars, and I suppose it's my age, if you like, because this is the 40th anniversary of the first really big mission to Mars, which was the Viking 1 lander, and it had a twin. It had a Viking 2 as well, but the first one was the Viking 1. Some people may remember it landed on the 20th of July 1976, and I was a kid at the time, and I remember being absolutely blown away. It's one of the things that got me into science, actually, seeing these pictures on the TV, these colour pictures coming back from Mars of this red planet full of rocks. It was just absolutely fantastic. So in 1976, anyway, what they were trying to do with this mission, which is important in the context of we're going now back to Mars in the 2030s, but this time we're going with astronauts, hopefully. That's certainly what Obama's talking about. It's going to cost a lot of money. But the goal in 76 was, there'd always been this chat about, is there life on Mars? Like the David Bowie song. So that was the mission back then. And they had the two probes at different experiments. And the idea was they were going to do experiments on the surface of Mars. There were three experiments on each. So we'll just take Viking 1 for example, because that's the most important one. So it had three three experiments that were going to test whether there is life on Mars. There was a little, one of them, which was the critical one, was used this little arm that scooped up some Martian soil, put it into a little container, and then they performed this experiment to see if there were any living microbes in that Martian soil there and then. Okay, and then there were two other ones which I won't go into. So the scientists said, if we get a majority, if we get two out of the three experiments that say that life exists on Mars, then we're going to announce life has been found on Mars. One of the experiments came up positive, and they thought, my God, we found, and I'll describe what they did there. And it seemed to be very conclusive, but unfortunately the other two didn't. So it was one out of three, so they never announced at the time in 76 we found life on Mars. They've since gone back and looked at that particular experiment, run it through these mathematical models. They've compared it to what you might expect in soil samples if you did the same analysis here on Earth, and they've said, this is definitely life. This is, you know, 40 years later, many reputable scientists have said, that result that they got in that experiment, that certainly indicates what we expect from living microbes in the soil to produce. What they did was quite simple and ingenious. They got the soil, they scooped it up, they mixed it with a drop of water, they put in some nutrients. So these would be things that little microbes or living things would ingest, would eat, if you like. And these nutrients had radioactive tags, so they had a little bit of radioactivity attached onto them. And they then expected, if there was CO2 or methane released, that's the gas we breathe out, you know, little microbes would breathe out, that gas would have little tags of radioactivity. So if you saw the radioactivity in the CO2 or methane gas that was produced after you did this little experiment, there's something breathing in the soil. You know, that was the thinking. And they used this radiation detector and they found a huge spike. The result, basically, the background radiation on Mars is about 50 or 60 counts, if you like, of radioactivity. And when they did this little experiment, there were 10,000 counts. So there was something very, very dramatic happening. And a lot of scientists believe it could only be one thing. It was the little microbes breathing in there. Now, why did they not announce it? Well, I told you why. But scientists believe that, look, that the other two experiments should possibly be treated in isolation. And this one experiment seems now, they've run it again and again, and it seems to show that actually there was life. And another thing that's interesting that supports that is that there's a thing that we all do, circadian rhythms. As humans, you know, that we live in a 24-hour world here. Mars is a 24.7-hour world, if you like. So if we sleep, we regulate our temperature, we eat, we do certain things in certain patterns. We're more active during the day, we sleep at night, that type of thing. So they picked up these circadian rhythms in the emissions of the gases coming out of the little experiment on Mars. So while they were running the experiment, they saw that if you assume that they're microbes or whatever they were in the soil, they were less active at night. There wasn't as much respiration going on.
So they're confident that something is there.
They're confident that something is there.
Right. Excellent. Okay.
Well, we have to go back in the 2030s to make sure to find out.
I look forward to it. Book your ticket now. Sean Duke, the cool scientist. Thanks for all those stories, Sean, and welcome back. We look forward to seeing you again very soon.
Thanks, Dec.